Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, here we are. At the dark of the moon. It's the dark of the moon. There'll be a new moon early next week. The dark of the moon is when people gather to determine the course of culture, so let's do everything we can. So, Jewish revolutionary nonviolence, guiding story strategies for necessary miracles. We re-welcome Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, explore legacies of Jewish and multi-heritage rituals born out of catastrophic loss and loving solidarity, share how ceremony functions in contemporary emergent multi-heritage faith networks dedicated to revolutionary nonviolence and social change. It's part of her upcoming course that we'll honor. So Lynn Gottlieb, one of the first women to become a rabbi in Jewish history, is a pioneer Jewish feminist, activist, writer, visual artist, ceremonialist, community organizer, master storyteller, and performing artist. She is co-founder of Shamarat Shalom Global Congregation. And I have to take a breath, there's so many good things. And teacher of the Path of the Torah of Nonviolence. She's director of youth and family programs in Berkeley, California. Author of She Who Dwells Within, A Practical Guide to Non-Sexist Judaism, many other things. Her website is Rabbi Lynn, L-Y-N-N, Gottlieb, G-O-T-T-L-I-E-B.com. Welcome, Rabbi Lynn.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, for that warm, wonderful welcome.
It's a great delight. So you were kind to come on KPFA and Fun Drive, and we reminded everybody that you were born 3 days before KPFA. If you were a radio station, you'd be KPFA. and then I was so delighted by everything you post on Facebook, but also by your upcoming course, four sessions, right, which is part of what I read to. Exploring the legacies of Jewish and multi-heritage rituals born out of catastrophic loss and loving solidarity. So, yeah, that begins on January 10th. And if you want to say a little more more about that as we go along.
Yes. Since October 7th, we have witnessed, the world has witnessed, rising up for Palestinian liberation in the face of massive catastrophic loss and genocidal policies by the state of Israel. And Jewish people and people in multi-faith and multi-heritage relationships with Jewish people are in the midst of creating strategies to respond and stop the genocide. We know that it's really helpful and affirming to draw on one's own culture and tradition to face this massive state violence. And so, as someone who teaches a Torah of nonviolence and who has been involved in revolutionary nonviolent struggles for most of my life, I wanted to support culture workers and activists, educators, regular people who are just coming into this conflict with some sources of resiliency and some tactics to use in action. And so there are three classes, January 10th, 17th, 24th. Some short sessions, 1 hour and 15 minute sessions from 4 to 5:15 Pacific Coast time. And a lot of resources for people to draw upon and a lot of opportunity to share people's experiences up to this point.
Yes. No, that's great. And you know, on the Visionary Activist Show Patreon page, you'll find out how to sign up for Rabbi Lynn's offering, and also on her Facebook page, you can find out how to sign up. And we'll be animating, magnetizing it. I'm going to sign up because absolutely, it's so crucial. I've been working this idea of diaspora. You know, it all starts off as one thing, and then it individuates into different traditions and different peoples and different tribes, and now it's sort of the cispora, calling in the liberating part of all traditions, as you just referenced. And just as a sidebar, in keeping with that, Sean Patrick O'Donohue and I are going to be holding a January 6th Zoom Council Epiphany, 12th night. We're taking it back, right, from our heritage. It's when the Magi, the astrologers, arrived bearing powerful symbolic gifts, right? It's when the good part of all of us arrives on 12th night. So we're, you know, hoovering back from, well, it just reminds us to animate powerful guiding metaphors, lest we leave them by default to the Dementors, right? So January 6th, we're taking this back, and that the Sean Patrick O'Donohue and my event will be Saturday, January 6th at 5 p.m. West Coast time, 8 p.m. East Coast time, and you can find out about that at coyotenetworknews.com. So, yeah, so all traditions, it's, again, underneath practice everything, and you'd wrote me such a wonderful, enthusiastic response to my invitation, saying, you know, you're excited to be sharing, and you said deeply inspired by the work of James Lawson, among others, one of your early teachers and a field worker with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and you said a force more powerful is a great resource for folks as well. It's a film and a book. Yes, I just watched it. So that's so great. Going, okay, James Lawson, and Rabbi Everett Gendler, born weeks apart, both of them dragons, and then just for the beauty of it, both of them had Jupiter at 9 degrees Taurus, whose image is a Red Cross nurse going into difficult situations to alleviate the plight of others. That's pretty perfect. But I'm so glad that you guided me and now us to James Lawson. Anything more you want to say to bring up his powerful contribution?
There is so much to say about Reverend James Lawson, who is still with us and still teaching people the strategies and history of nonviolence, and his wonderful book, Revolutionary Nonviolence, Organizing for Freedom, is available. It just came out recently. It's short, so very readable. And he is a person who had faith in the power of nonviolence as a strategy for change. And I am so grateful that I grew up with that strategy for change in my earlier years, because it is where hope resides. Hmm. One can easily feel overwhelmed and despairing, especially if one is a person of empathy and feels the loss and suffering that so many people undergo. Nonviolence is grounded and rooted in hope and faith that nonviolence can change and bring down and dismantle state violence and military violence. And the last 150 years have proven this to be true. Nonviolence, people who resist using the tool, the many, many hundreds of tools of nonviolence, have a better chance of succeeding in stopping violence. Gene Sharp, another amazing teacher of nonviolence, identified 101 strategies of nonviolent resistance. But of course, there's many more. It's continually evolving, and we see creative nonviolence being taken up by people all over the world as for people who are directly confronting the state violence and people who are working in solidarity from afar or from close by. And so I wanted to share the traditional strategies along with contemporary strategies within Jewish tradition for resisting state violence and the violence of empire and militarism, which was always, up until 1948, seen as abhorrent and contradictory to the main goal of what we might call Jewish religion. Religion and Torah was created as a tool to resist violence, not as a tool to justify violence, which it's being used today. So when you said take back, I feel very much that it is time to take back the authentic voice of Jewish spiritual culture and wield it against state violence.
Right. And then just in my own style over here, I like saying there's resisting state violence and then there's dissolving straight violence, going just adding just different images for dissolving the thing. But so grateful for your dedication and then your being such a good go over here, you know, in listening to you and also watching the movie Force More Powerful, which features, you know, James Lawson and many, many important beings. But it's reminding us of the great alliance, the great Jewish traditional alliance of advocacy for all those oppressed. And it's like, right, allies, remembering that, you know, tracking everything back to its essence. And remembering, seeing in that movie where the discipline of what we call nonviolence, the training sessions where insults and provocations were hurled upon those who were getting ready to do the sit-in at the lunch counter or the whatever, being trained to not react, not resist, being hurtled with taunting, right? And it's like, what? And then they speak of the common discipline, the fierce training, and the long-term persistence, right? So it's deep dedication. So it's so good to remember this and bring it alive as you're doing now and as you're doing in your course, to bring forth. And then, you know, last time we spoke about your book and the Shekhinah. I'm still working on the pronunciation. You say it.
Shekhinah.
That's so beautiful. Years and years ago, actually in 1982, I saw one of the best theatrical performances I've ever seen. It was the Traveling Jewish Theater in San Francisco. And it was the return of the Shekhinah. I don't know if you ever saw such a thing.
Yes. I met Corey and Albert in New York City for one of the first Jewish theater festivals in New York at the time. We met there and as storytellers, along with Naomi, we've had many encounters. Yes.
Well, that's so great because it's you know, the liberating of everything. And I just remember it was like, oh, for everybody, the Shekhinah, the return of the prophetic feminine of whatever's been exiled. And I feel, you know, to reach into all traditions for the liberating, dissolving of state violence, part of every tradition, and to bring it forth and animate it. And did James Lawson and Rabbi Everett Gendler know each other?
Yes, they did, through the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And also because Everett was in Selma in Birmingham and in Albany, Georgia, where he got arrested and was part of what people sometimes call the civil rights movement, others call it the Black Freedom Movement. Yes, they knew each other.
Well, that's great because they're both. Oh, sorry, you go.
Yeah, and they're both very inspiring. I met Reverend Lawson before I met Rabbi Gendler, and I knew of other rabbis like Michael Robinson, Rabbi Michael Robinson, also deceased, Alav Shalom, may his memory be a blessing, who also was deeply involved in the Black freedom struggle in the South. He was from the South. And his Reverend Lawson's brother, Phil Lawson, as well. I don't want to forget Reverend Lawson's brother, Phil, who's also in the Bay Area and joined the Fellowship of Reconciliation when he was just 19. And that provided different strategies of change. Reverend Lawson went to India to study Gandhian nonviolent tactics and was deeply influenced not just by the resistance piece but also resistance and non-cooperation, which goes hand in hand with building and creating the world that we want to see. So that's the dissolving but also building the scaffolding for the world that we want to come into being, so we can make sanctuaries for that world to thrive when we engage in multi-faith, multi-heritage, cross-cultural, revolutionary nonviolence as we both resist and build the new ways of creating our relationships.
That's great, yeah, and creating these sanctuaries of multi-faith, these places that we can all tap into of non-reactive, powerful dedication. And, you know, it's like I've often said, you know, all war is a failure of imagination, and I can get warmongers to agree to that. But then I like to keep working with things going and then go, if all war is a failure of imagination, then all peace is a triumph of imagination. And that's what you're up to as well, to vitalize the desirable image. And you know, and the again the movie that you guided us to, A Force More Powerful, which is also a book, you know, it had in South Africa, rather than Denmark? Oh no, you'll have to guide me. But rather than sabotage, yes. Strike. Rather than sabotage, strike. And it's like, and then when we tease that here, you know, we want to dissolve many things, state violence, but also the stranglehold of, you know, APEC. It turns out that if your house has been flooded in Texas and you want government relief, you have to sign a statement saying that you do not support BDS, you do not support boycott against Israel. It's amazing. Do you know
this is a very difficult moment for people resisting U.S. and Israeli state violence. United States is paying for the war. The weapons being dropped, the weapons used, the bombs being dropped, are paid for by the United States. So the United States is a partner in genocide. And then there's an entire McCarthy-like machine being wielded to silence critics by criminalizing the nonviolent tactics like boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which was used so successfully in South Africa and also in the South, and drawing on those formats of resistance are powerful modalities. The course that I'm teaching also draws on the spiritual modalities that are both forms of non-cooperation and witness and peace building as another tactic for transforming our communities and holding our elected officials accountable. Many officials will not even call for a ceasefire, which is hard really to understand why that is, unless one understands that there is just so much pressure from, you might say, the powerful people in our communities who are equating critique and resistance of militarism and genocide with anti-Semitism, which is such an, it's so wrong. It's just wrong to do that. It's incorrect to do that. In fact, the prophetic tradition is all about critiquing the state of Israel. That was the ancient state of Israel. But that's what, and our tradition, Judaism, moves from the Torah, which everybody knows has a lot of violence within it, and then is, you might say, interpreted or filtered through the prophetic tradition, which calls to account the violence of the kings and the Judean state, followed by the rabbinic tradition, which in which revolutionary nonviolence really takes root within Jewish culture and life. So much so that I might have even quoted this last time, I can't remember, but so much so that when the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv from 1936 through 46 spoke about the world and the militarism of the world, he says, "Through what means do we blot out those who glorify the sword? How are we to bring an end to the world's militarism? The view of Judaism is evil cannot be extirpated by evil means. Terror cannot be eliminated through the use of counter-terror. Therefore, one cannot destroy a, quote, strong arm, unquote, with a strong arm. And one cannot obliterate a sword with a sword. When Judaism declares a war against militarism, it cannot declare it through militarism. About this, it is said, write this in a book of remembrance, wage war against the sword with the book." So in this statement, we see that the view of Judaism is that militarism and force, harmful force, is an anathema to Jewish spiritual culture. And this is being destroyed by the Israeli government and the Israeli military, and those who are justifying its actions. It is not in alignment with 2,000 years of Jewish tradition. And we know that things can easily be forgotten, sometimes in a generation. And that is why we need to reinvest in sources of revolutionary nonviolence within our tradition.
Right. And what is so crucial and important to all of this and to what you're bringing up is it is a connection to the earth. You know, in reading about Rabbi Everett Gendler, you know, Jewish nonviolence, you know, therefore choose life, but egalitarian Judaism. I want to put some things out and come back over it with you too. Jewish environmentalism, right? He was inspired by Helen and Scott Deering. Radio guests of mine, love them, lived with them. It's calling everybody, right? Organic farmers, and he was a vegetarian. And in 1978, the solar-powered eternal light on the roof of the synagogue in Lowell, Massachusetts, was lit. And we go, oh. And then he also was on the march from Selma to Montgomery, 1965. It says he was instrumental in Martin Luther King Jr. addressing the National Rabbinical Convention on March 25th, 1968. 10 days before he died. Pretty powerful alliance there on every level. It's like, whew. And I'm looking at Rabbi Gendler's chart, a Leo with planets and the moon exalted and Taurus, and it's like, oh, he did it. He did ceremony connected to the earth. You know, and that seems a part of it. It's like the tyrants don't care if they're hated as long as the people don't love each other. Tyrants don't care if they're hated as long as the people don't love the earth. So is that also part of, you know, all of us really yearning, but what Rabbi Everett Gendler was dedicated to, which is that it's all kinned with the earth, as indeed the Aramaic language is metaphorically kinned with earth. Does that?
Yes, absolutely. One of the reasons I loved Everett so much. I believe it's one of the reasons he chose to ordain me in the tradition of Jewish nonviolence and to begin to lift it up in a new way in our time. He was deeply involved in multi-faith and multi-heritage work, and he believed in centering people who are directly impacted by state, social, economic violence, and taking cues and guidance and shaping tactics around people who directly experience state violence, and to create settings so their voices are heard, which is one of the reasons he brought Martin Luther King to speak to the conservative rabbis. And the King's talk to the rabbis and the rabbinic response is very revealing. It can be, I think one can understand it in King's letter from Birmingham jail and critiquing liberals who are not willing to take risks and who want things to go very slowly and incrementally, and instead of responding immediately to the terrible and traumatic violence that people who are directly impacted experience. So there's a sense of urgency coming from the letter, and I felt that my teacher, Rabbi Everett Gendler, felt that urgency in his life. And as someone who deeply respected growing feminism, he also chose to support my own journey toward the rabbinate as one of the first women rabbis, which was a revolutionary act as well, especially since I was not in the mold of the institutional rabbinate. I was, you know, dealing with completely other issues than most male rabbis because we're going to come on the front line.
We're going to come right back after our short break right on this radical equality theme to which you're dedicated and humming in all of us. Our guest today is Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb. We are honoring Jewish revolutionary nonviolence and that which, from all traditions, to come on back in, that which is egalitarian. connected to the earth. And then our break music is Palestina, the song that was written by George Tatari in 1978, a Palestinian then living in Sweden, and the music is Swedish. And the lyrics are actually very beautiful. We harvest the wheat, we're connected to the land, we love the olives, the thing, just right, connection to the land. So here's our brief break music, and we'll be right back after this.
Liebe, liebe, liebe Palestina. Liebe Palästina, liebe Palästina, und großer Zionisten. Liebe Palästina, und großer Zionisten.
Und wir har odlat jorden.
Und wir har odlat jorden.
Und wir har skördat vetet.
Und wir har skördat vetet.
Vi har plockat citronerna.
Och vi har plockat citronerna.
Och pressat oliverna.
Och pressat oliverna.
Och
hela världen känner till vår jord. Leve, leve, leve Palestina. Leve, leve, leve Palestina. Leve Palestina och krossa sionismen. Leve Palestina och krossa sionismen.
Och vi har kastat stenar på.
Och vi har kastat stenar på.
Soldater och poliser.
Soldater och poliser.
Och vi har skjutit raketer.
Och vi har skjutit raketer.
I dance every night with the dogs through the neighborhood to that song. It's so rousing. And just to remind people that I found a wonderful version of it with the meanings, with the subtitles, right? And you can find that, you know, well, many places, but also at Patreon Visionary Activist Show and other places that we will post things. But the words are about connection to the land. We love the olives. We're harvesting the olives. We stir the wheat. We are of the land. Remember, word indigenous means sprung from the land. So, yeah, and that's our break music. We are hosting Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb this hour. And I just had to use that music because I dance to it everywhere. Just, it's very powerful and beautiful. So do you dance around to that, Rabbi Lynn?
I dance to a lot of things. That is a beautiful, beautiful song. And the olive tree, which means so much, meant so much in Jewish tradition. Because the olive oil is so pure, it is the chosen oil to light the sacred lights of our holidays and festivals. And one of the most profound sorrows that I ever witnessed was the pulling out of a farmer's olive trees when the apartheid wall was being built, and families were watching their trees being uprooted, trees that are hundreds of years old, trees that take, you know, people say it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to grow a tree as well. And they last longer than a single generation. And so it takes generations of people to create the conditions for olive trees to thrive. And olive trees are indigenous to the Holy Land. The fact that genocide is not only a genocide of human beings, it's also a genocide of the land, the complete
yes.
destruction of the land. And that myth of a land without a people and a people without a land that Golda Meir perpetuated and people perpetuate was an erasing of the millennium of culture and spirituality that are associated with the stewardship of olive trees So, yes.
Yeah,
and that leads me kind of also to the idea of altar and offerings, which we'll be looking at on January 10th. The idea that we need to be making a lot of atonement offerings for all of the violence and destruction we've unleashed upon Palestinian people, and to create altars of remembrance and recognition as we bring our protest into the public sphere through ceremonial expression.
Yeah. So yeah. No protest and the Native pipeline changing the word, you know, from protester to protectors and the ceremonial realm. Yes. And atonement, altars of remembrance, remorse, dedication, and the olive trees. Yeah. Just let me stress what you said. Yeah, since 1948, between 800,000 and 1 million olive trees have been uprooted. And as you say, they are an integral part of Palestinian economy and Palestinian life. But they are, as olive trees are to people in truly, you know, in the land and Palestinians, so caribou to the Gwich'in. It's a deep connection to the land that must not be severed. And that's really what we're looking at everywhere, you know, and All Stories Guide Us to All Stories, right? This colonization and forceful separation of people who know how to steward the land and live with it with respect in an all-embracing diverse community, you know, stripped from it, right? So it's the focus is, you know, Gaza now and the, you know, what Jewish allies have called the cult of Israel. And then just to say what you'd said, but we're all learning so much. You know, that it takes 20 years to grow an olive tree and 20 more years before it bears fruit, right? So just as you say, generations tending this and the weeping of the families as they see their groves that their grandfather tended being bulldozed and burned in front of them. And we go, so
no,
what are visions that we want? Well, we want planting. You know, well, there's great promising rising up in Israel, great, you know, common sense, wonderful democracy going, war is not the answer, we could live peaceably. And just underneath everything to go, it could be beautiful, the land, the regrowing of the olive trees. The, you know, is that a vision also on your altar? Like,
yes.
Olive trees returning?
Of course, right now I feel that the peaceful... The tree of life that is the true symbol of Jewish life, represented by the seven-branch menorah, is an olive tree, an almond tree, you know, fruit tree. But in this moment, so the bird that has the branch, this is a bridge that we can build. These are things that are sacred to people who love the land. And we need to be engaged in massive replanting. And some people are, for instance, some listeners may have visited the Tent of Nations, where the Nassars have owned their land and deeds to their land for over 100 years. And the Israeli courts oppress them by making them come in and not settling, whether the deed is recognized or not. And they plant trees, and then the trees are uprooted, and then people plant again, and then the trees are uprooted. One of the things that I treasure on my own altar is some sage, Palestinian sage, that was grown on that land and given to me by Daoud. And I always, at Tashlich ceremony, at a ceremony of casting off sins that that Chavurah for Free Palestine that's associated with Kehillah Synagogue, Chavurah for Free Palestine had such a casting off in front of Israeli bonds, which many states invest in, many state governments invest in. People don't realize that. And so I took some of that sage and we ripped up the Israeli bonds and we put them in a great big pot with the sage and water. And then I turned that into a kind of papier-mâché altar that I brought back to Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, in which an overflowing crowd on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the afternoon came and expressed their vision of what they hoped every synagogue and their own synagogue and every Jewish community would do, which is to declare themselves not just ceasefire, that's a very important, but deeply committed to an ongoing promise of ending, of resisting and ending, dissolving apartheid as a legitimate expression of the so-called Jewish state. I can't really say Jewish state, there's nothing Jewish about that state, but the State of Israel, and this is one methodology of taking offerings and altars and using them in a public way to give witness to a different way forward by both acknowledging accountability and making reparations and guaranteeing that harms are ended and will not be repeated.
Public ceremony, public ritual, public theater, you know, leading to molecular opportunity to do more things. But yeah, no, it's you're stirring. You know, and I remember that it was the winter, the Christmas of 1975 into the New Year's of 1976 that friends of mine, we went to with Dick Gregory to Ralph Abernathy's Baptist Church in Atlanta, and we were all fasting for a week. And some of the just great civil rights leaders came to talk to us and to Dick Gregory, and they spoke about the spiritual power, you know, tangible power, you know, of the nonviolence and the fasting. They said they'd been fasting, and one of their friends who had not been fasting and hadn't had his deep dedication going on was visiting them in a tent when a man walked in and shot them all. And they showed us the bullet wounds, but they said those of us who were fasting, and they said they showed us the bullets fell out. I go, okay, all right. And their friend who was visiting, who had not been fasting or just the level of dedication, was grievously injured and then recovered. But they were like, you know, these are tangible parts of spiritual magic, they said. You know, the power of dedication, you know, can begin to keep one safe, you know, and just adding to the lore. But I think we're invited to remember everything that's ever been meaningful or useful to us in all of our traditions, and to go, come on back up, you know, and that idea of the syncretism as a sacrament. I love what you were doing with the herb, the sage, the Palestinian sage, and it's like, ooh, that's very wonderful. Right, so it's social action with symbolic, literal magic. It's the power of sage and then also you're doing Jewish witchcraft, yeah, but we don't need to tell people that.
There is transformative magic in ceremony, no doubt.
Yes,
no doubt. When you connect to life-giving forces and you draw on the strength of the earth and our spiritual capacity for love and for solidarity and healing, there's transformative magic in those actions. I think a lot also about pilgrimage. There have been many marches. I like to think of them as pilgrimages because I've been on so many pilgrimages to sites of wounding where terrible atrocities have been committed and are committed, whether it's in front of detention centers, in the Inland Empire here in California, with the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity, or vigils in front of City Hall, where people walk from place to place, or what I created with my friend Abdul Rauf Campos Marchetti after 2002 in an effort to safeguard the Muslim community in New Mexico, where we walked from our synagogue to the masjid. And within 3 days, within 5 days when we first announced the pilgrimage, when we agreed to do this pilgrimage, and we wrote our statement, 350 people joined us from Buddhist, Sufi, Muslim, all kinds of Christian, ethnic diversities, racial diversities. We marched this 6.6 miles from my synagogue to the masjid. It was such a powerful walk, a prayerful walk, that when we began, an indigenous elder from Okawinge came, and as he was giving us, praying over us with cornmeal, one of those magical moments of a hot air balloon, a rainbow balloon, floated in front of the synagogue. And everybody was just like, oh, wow, this is amazing. And then we walked, and we were greeted with so much heart by the Muslim community at the masjid, at the mosque, that this gave birth to over 22 peace walks throughout the United States and Canada. So when there is power in our coming together that has a spiritual root and does involve acknowledgement, accountability, healing, reparations, and public witness, it is a force more powerful. It has the power to transform people's hearts and minds and to build the movement for social change.
Yeah. Well, because everywhere, it's everywhere, but we're looking at the Israel-Gaza part of our dream, you know, the kind of mass psychosis by which much of the Israeli population has been seized, it's like into this, you know, vituperative polarity, and I do think of it as like a possession. But from underneath, again, the sparks that we're all looking for, the kinship sparks, which is sane, reverent common sense being spoken, and, you know, kind of powerful rising up, you know, and, you know, honoring that magic. And I'd say that, you know, right now as we're convening, you know, the son's image is a children's ward in a hospital, which is Zelensky's Mercury, just for the foot of whatever. But it's got a quintile to Neptune. So again, powerful images and dedications and prayers are eager to incarnate into actuality, you know, into the plight of, well, there's so many, right? There's so many stories, any one of which should bring us all and the world down to its knees. You know, the Palestinian ambassador at the UN who broke down in tears, this young girl whose whole family was killed and she lost her legs in amputation, but she gave this spirited interview going, I want to become a doctor, I want to work in a children's ward, there we are. I want to help people, I want to get prosthetics for my legs, and I'm determined to live. And then she was killed the next day by the bombing of the hospital. And it's like, oh, stuff. But this heart opening and the soul sickness of people separated from the land that has caused everywhere some to become hard-hearted, right? And that's the dissolving, right? The dissolving back into like, whoa, ooh, the empathy and the kinship, which is so much, you know, a part of ritual, but also a part of powerful music, you know. And I love what you said again, the vigils, right? The so many ways to be. And I think, you know, it's somewhere in the movie, a force more powerful, that when they say, okay, no, we decided not sabotage, but strikes. And some of the strikes can be 2 minutes long. I don't know if you remember that part of the movie. I don't remember the context going, okay, a 2-minute strike. All right. But it's experimental now, right? It's like try things that are powerful moments of dedication. Yeah.
Nonviolence is a very creative force. And it literally springs from the environment itself, so that the best, those who carry the wisdom of the place are creatively responding in ways that don't dehumanize the other, but maintain their own humanity, even as they struggle to evoke the humanity of the other, which is very hard to do when bombs are being dropped on your head. And this is why people have been using the language of genocide, because the situation is so acute and we're in the midst of it. We know that just the amount of the 50,000 women in Gaza who are pregnant right now have no help in delivering their children. And when we say genocide, we mean the conscious elimination of another people. Well, when you're not providing any medical care, this or access even to water or food, this is a genocidal policy. So because the situation is so acute, our lament and our direct action must be public. We must take actions that hold our public officials accountable. And we have to let them know that if they don't take action now, we will withdraw our electoral support.
Yeah,
we will withdraw it.
Right.
That's non-cooperation. And we have to say it has to be love over fear. It must be love over fear. We must be creating conditions where everyone thrives. We have to look at this conflict not as something that began on October 7th with the criminal and horrendous attack of Israeli civilians, but collective punishment to the degree that it's being perpetrated on Palestinians is a genocidal act. And as hard as that is for people to both hold the grief that both communities are feeling for loss and to demand accountability, these things must go together.
Let's honor all of that. Yes, the politics, the Biden administration, the like, oh my God, the things that need to be dissolved, the orthodox Israeli lobby that is so tight, you know, and it's intensely painful to watch the Biden administration at first just coughing politely, like, excuse me, could you just not kill quite so many citizens in quite such an obvious way, cough, cough. Now, apparently, there's backstage real some kind of face-off, and there was the call, and Norman Finkelstein, may he be praised, God love him, you know, was saying, you know, we have a public announcement, Biden, you know, we pledge to not vote for you because of this hard-hearted, this terrible moral lapse that you have. And I just put back in the comments going, wheel and deal, just why not put, you know, if this does not happen right now, then we will not vote. There will be these realistic. I just wanted to put it out there as a like, things are moving all too slowly. But
And we can be thankful that Barbara Lee is taking leadership on this. That, and we call on Alex Padilla to also join in public declaration of ceasefire now, permanent ceasefire now.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah,
and Governor Newsom as well.
Where has he been on all of this?
Nowhere. Quiet. Yeah.
Nowhere. That won't do.
Nowhere.
That won't do. That's part of us all gathering to go. This is what we were willing to inaugurate, which comes from the augur, the diviner in all of us. You know, coming up on Epiphany as well, that would discern, nature would reveal the most responsible human who would steward the land, and then they would be inaugurated. And it's like, well, this is the job description. You know, this is the necessity. You know, who steps up for this? And it's true, can't be compromised on this to go, Trump can't win. It's like, no, first we deal with this. Is, you know, permanent ceasefire crucial? But again, there is the powerful. There's the song. There's the rising up. There's all of these powerful things. There's your days of vigil. And again, I just want to, as we're on our way out, to recommend Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb's course on Jewish revolutionary nonviolence that you can find at RabbiLynnGottlieb.com, and I'll remind you that Sean Patrick O'Donohue and I will be doing an Epiphany January 6th, inhaling back January 6th, 12th night on January 6th at 5 p.m. West Coast time, 8 p.m. East Coast time. CoyoteNetworkNews.com is where you can find out more about that. But thank you so much. Let us be in cahoots. I look forward to attending your course, RabbiLynnGottlieb.com. Thanks always, Kirsten Thomas. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Thanks again, Rabbi Lynn. Woof woof.
Thank you so much.